You think that for Unitarian Universalists, the big challenges would be those religious holidays and holy days. That repetitious calendar that presents Christmas and Easter and Passover and all kinds of these religious holidays and holy days that clergy keep trying to get a new angle on. And how is it that we, particularly as Unitarian Universalists, walk that line between something that is new and innovative and completely incoherent, or honoring the past in some kind of literal way? How do we struggle with all of those great religious issues that have theological implications, mystical implications, godly implications? I want to tell you that those issues are child's play compared to Memorial Day. And Sue touched on the really essential tensions that I know that I feel, and given what Sue had to say, I'm sure many of us feel, between honoring the warriors who brought us to this moment, whose lives and sacrifices and woundedness of body and spirit and gifts of life itself were a tragic necessity, and our feelings about war and its ultimate madness, its ultimate futility. There are never wars that actually end all wars, no matter how we advertise and market them. There are never wars that make it forever different and forever better, because the good news and the bad news of human history is that we fight again and again to win, to put into peril, to lose, and to win back things that we have fought for in the past. And so wars are never wars that end all wars, except perhaps when we look at some final apocalyptic war that may be the war to end all humanity. That is possible, but I don't think that's the outcome for which most of us are either praying or working or hoping or whatever constellation of Unitarian Universalist words you want to put into what it is that we do when we look around this world. And we see the anger, and we see the hostility, and we also acknowledge all of the people who, when called, said yes and served and gave us the opportunity to be here, to celebrate, to mourn, to protest, to be as free as we can be in working and fighting for the kind of world that we would like to see. Memorial Day is one of those holidays that is kind of easy to gloss over with a couple of quick sentimental words. It's easy to get distracted into, well, it really is all about a white sale, a three-day sale for new bedding and a good time to change batteries in your smoke alarms. And it's the beginning of the barbecue season, so we can celebrate that part unabashedly. Even the vegans out there, you can barbecue eggplant. It works out okay. The closest thing that most of the time that we get to really dealing with the cost and the responsibility of our humanity is when life is really in peril, is either on the highway or at the Indianapolis 500, where brave men and women risk their lives for fairly silly reasons. As the late, great Jim Murray said, the opening words to the Indianapolis 500 should be, "Gentlemen, start your coffins." We are a violent species. It just is an inescapable part of our heritage. We human beings are not the fastest animals, not the strongest animals. It's still open whether we're even the brightest of animals. We'll have to talk to the dolphins someday and find out how they managed to make that nice choice to stay away from those thumbs. And by not having thumbs, they didn't need nuclear buttons. So what made us partially, and this is part of that non-sentimental history of humanity, is violence and the hunt and the war. We have to look, I think, with intellectual honesty at what we are as a species. We learned how to bring down big, hairy, woolly mammoths because we learned how to cooperate, because we learned how to communicate. We built weapons, and that was the beginning of our technology that helped us in this dialogue that we have between ourselves and our world, between each other, that created language and communication and technology. All of the dangers of the world served to bring us together to develop language skills, cooperation skills, hunting skills, and technology. The first rock was probably used to bash in the head of a saber-toothed tiger before it was shaped as a pestle to grind pesto. We went from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age, and the Bronze Age people beat up the Stone Age people because it was superior weaponry that did it. And then on to the Iron Age, and again, technology in the service of destruction. It is a mixed heritage and an inherent tension that we celebrate on a day like Memorial Day as we acknowledge the humanity and the inhumanity, the intelligence and the folly that bring us to these moments. I look back at the various war memorials that I have visited, how profoundly touched I was, as many of you know, by the Vietnam War Memorial, because it was the war of my generation, the war that my generation fought and fought against, the war that changed lives of friends, ended lives of friends, certainly ended lives of strangers, and changed their families both here and abroad forever. I look at the new memorial for the greatest generation, the new memorial in Washington, D.C., for the veterans of World War II who made this life possible. Very personally, I take this for me and for my family. Had Germany won, I wouldn't be here in any sense, nor would my wife or her family. And I take those sacrifices very seriously. People criticize the monument, and they say it looks funereal. It looks like a cemetery. Well, 400,000 of our soldiers died. Over 20 million human beings died in World War II. It should be somber. The cost of freedom is an awful, in the sense of awe, in every sense, price that humanity and inhumanity together pay. I can't help but be ambivalent about it. I can't help but be ambivalent about what I keep calling in my head a tragic necessity, the tragic necessity to fight, and yet there were people with courage, like the Mahatma Gandhi, the great soul, like the great soul Tom Cooney over here, who said no, who said that's not what I do. And that is an extraordinarily brave and courageous stance, and it's not one that I believe that I'm capable of. It's one that I respect so deeply. when I look at civil disobedience and the history that civil disobedience and peaceful resistance has had in our world, I am awestruck by the discipline and the goodness of people who have been able to practice it. It is remarkable. I find myself flying off the handle at very minor things, and I don't trust myself to sit passively by while being shot at, while being hosed, while being dragged off, while being beaten, while being kicked, while dying. But there are people who do, who can, who lead, and who have the discipline and the core belief to follow, and I am in awe of that. But I also look towards the humanity of the adversary. And I look at Mahatma Gandhi leading his people in passive resistance against the British and counting on the British eventually to come to terms with their own humanity, to eventually come to terms with the horror of what they were doing to passive men, women, and children. And he counted on them to, at some point, after so much violence, after so much killing, for the British to turn in on themselves and ask themselves, who is the savage and who is the civilized in this encounter? And at some point, enough of them did, and the British stepped back. Martin Luther King depended upon an inherent goodness in the majority of the American people, and he was lucky enough for this to happen during an age when there was television, where we could not sit passively and only hear somebody's news reports, but many of my generation and an older generation looked at those dogs being loosed on peaceful demonstrators and said, those dogs and those sheriffs and those laws and that brutality, they do not represent who I am. And instead of turning off the televisions and wanting it to go away, we looked, we learned, and we changed. I think that our civilization, our society, is asking some of those same questions when we see what has happened at the prison in Abu Ghraib, and we are asking about our own selves and our own civilization, and it's making us confront our humanity and our inhumanity, of which all human beings sharing the same DNA are capable of. And we are asking, is this who we are and what we want to be? There's a terribly important question that I don't know the answer to. Well, there are a lot of them. But the one for today is, would passive resistance and civil disobedience work, have worked against the Nazis? Would they have come to their senses and found their conscience before the world was irrevocably crippled? Would it work against Al-Qaeda and people who get meaning, more meaning in their deaths than in their lives, or must some other series of strategies be used in order to help people get meaning from their lives rather than from their deaths? And I don't know the answer to that question. I know that today it is still a violent world. I know that today human beings are still asked to offer the ultimate sacrifice, which they believe is their lives, and sometimes it's more. Sometimes it is the body survives and the soul is irrevocably wounded and death is brief, but woundedness can endure forever. That we still have a world that tries to settle disputes with violence, but disputes are seldom, if ever, settled. There are moments of relative peace. There are moments of disengagement. There are moments when we can live and grow and hope, but there's never a war that ends a war because someone's relative, son, father, sister, mother, has died, and there is a memory of what that pain and what that rage feels like, and it carries on and it endures. Is there a better way? God, I hope so, and we work for that day. Not simply pray and hope, but work for that day, one step at a time, trying not to have that radical hatred that separates human being from human being. We try to understand that there are no holy wars, that holy wars is an oxymoron. There are wars that we may have to fight, but it is never holy to take another life. It may be necessary, I don't know that, but it is not holy. This I do know. There are so many monuments on the Capitol Mall. There's so many monuments with names inscribed in the central place in every town in France and every town in England. The numbers of people who have died for flag, for king, for crown, for life, for glory, for defense. And it goes on and on in an endless cycle. How do we break it? How do we work for a day? Can we hope for a day when we can go to those monuments and see them as quaint? When we can go to those monuments and remember humanity's primitive savanna and jungle past and understand that we don't do that anymore. We have found better ways, more permanent ways, more humane ways to settle our disputes, to exorcise our rage. It's so much a part of us and where we came from. The violence is in our metaphors. The violence is in our history. The violence is in our religion. From Cain slaying Abel to God burning up Sodom and Gomorrah, to the killing of the firstborn Egyptian, from the apocalyptic materials in the New Testament to that final earthquake in the Quran. It's a violent humanity with violent deities, and no, just switching from monotheism to polytheism, as one scholar proposed, is not the answers. Those gods in Greece and in Norway were just as violent with each other as any constellation of gods. Our violence is in how we train ourselves. It's in how we grow up. Our sports are all not simply metaphors of war. He's going to throw the bomb. They're also practiced for war, from putting the shot to pole vaulting, from soccer and the acquisition of territory, and football, the acquisition and defense of territory. Our sports are ways that we train and prepare ourselves unthinkingly to go to war, to practice war rather than to practice peace. Our modern technology is a cause and effect loop where our children are paying good money, or we are paying good money for our children to be practicing the multitasking to destroy incoming enemies and objects, and not to see them as human beings, but simply as representations of some phantom on a screen and depersonalize it. How do we break these patterns and make war quaint? I think we begin by remembering the cost, by taking Memorial Day seriously, and sometimes standing at those monuments and weeping. Because while it is true that the dead do not sleep in those monuments, we carry them in our hearts, we learn by understanding our loss and our cost of those who, whether they are in a better place or a different place, are no longer here sharing this life and this beautiful day and these opportunities and possibilities with us, and we get to mourn that. We get to grieve that, and we get to work for a day when we build no more monuments to our destructive impulses, when we are able to work one tiny, tiny day at a time and step at a time to stop the hate. Maybe we can't stop war today. Maybe I can't choose for other people to stop the killing. But I can choose by an act of conscience and will not to hate, not to give in to the hate and the enthusiasm that lets me turn the adversary into the enemy, into the vermin, into the less than human, that perpetuates the tears and the building of marble monuments. We all have a responsibility for what we do, and some control over what we feel. And I think we begin inside our hearts, and then let some sense of our shared and mutual humanity move from heart to hand. Maybe quivering, maybe frightened, but move in that direction. Because, as someone has pointed out a long time ago, if we don't learn how to adapt to a modern world and the modern technology, the next war will again be fought with stones.